Looks like he just joined us.
Okay. Yeah, I see him.
Okay.
All right, let's roll on. Good afternoon. It's 12 p.m. here at the Naturopathic Medical Board meeting. And with us today, our executive director is Ms. Gail Anthony. Mr. Hutchinson is representing the state from the Attorney General's office. And we have Mr. Graves, who are representing the board on case number 8 of the agenda. And I'll move on. Can we do formal roll call, please?
Yes. Dr. Sadlick?
Here.
Ms. Gallen?
Here.
Dr. Campbell?
Here.
Dr. Spatt?
Here.
Dr. Brown?
Here.
Mr. Mallar? Mr. Mallar? He was on.
He's muted.
Yes, because I do see him on the line. Mr. Mallar, we can't hear you. Well, I do see him on the line, Dr. Sadler.
Yeah, I see him.
Okay.
Okay. And roll call's done. And let's do conflicts of interest. We haven't received any, so I'll proceed on. Civility statement. In accordance with the open meeting law, the board has a civility policy that prohibits any type of disorderly conduct that disrupts the board from carrying out our business. Those violating this policy will be asked once. If you don't modify your behavior, we'll disconnect you. Let's go ahead and move on to number 4A. And we'll run 4A. If I can get a second, I appreciate it. 4A all the way through 4S, as in Sam.
Dr. Spatt, I second that motion.
Thank you, Dr. Spatt.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries.
Okay, so let's go on to number 5. We're going to number 5A, and this is with Dr. Michelle Pettit, case number 24-265. This is the initial review, and Ms. Anthony, can you give us an overview of this?
Yes. Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, on 7/23 of 2024, the board received a voice message from a member of the public indicating one of our licensees from the Globe, Arizona area had been convicted of a felony. The caller mentioned the physician's name, but it was inaudible in the message. She did also mention the name of the clinic as Chapter 1 Wellness Center. A quick search found the physician was, in fact, Dr. Michelle Pettit. The caller did leave a phone number, and 2 return calls were placed with the message for a callback. However, the board never received a return call on that. A search of online court documents disclosed 2 cases. One was for aggravated harassment, and one was for unlawful jury disclosure. The cases appear to originate from some type of dispute between respondent and the Miami Unified School District. Respondent failed to notify the board of these matters as required by R418-111.
And Dr. Pettit, are you on the line?
I am.
Are you have counsel or are you speaking for yourself?
I do have counsel.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Attorney Rachel Moss.
Hi. Dr. Pettit, can you speak for us or will Ms. Moss be doing that for you?
I'll be speaking for Dr. Pettit today.
Okay. So Ms. Moss, could you give us a real quick rundown then?
Yes. Of note, after that original jury trial in which Dr. Pettit was found guilty, there was a discovery that significant evidence had been failed to be presented to the jury in their deliberation room. Basically, some of the exhibits were left out. So the state's exhibits were brought to the jury room where defense exhibits were left out. Because of this, it was declared a mistrial. Dr. Pettit went back to trial, and she was acquitted by a jury of her peers. So Dr. Pettit has no felony convictions related to this matter. They have all been dismissed, all vacated, and she was later acquitted of these charges after all the proper evidence was presented to the jury.
Okay. And is there any reason Dr. Pettit or Ms. Moss, why you didn't report it to the board?
The conviction specifically?
Yeah, just the board has to be notified in reference. Well,
the convictions were reported by that other party before that 10-day window. So we were under the understanding the board was aware of the convictions.
Okay. Let me, Ms. Anthony, do you know when we got the notification?
So the call came in from the member of the public on 7/23 of 2024. It looks like the unlawful grand jury disclosure was submitted to the court on 10/19 of 23, and the original criminal aggravated harassment was filed with the court on 11/29/2022. So that is not within the 10-day window, according to R418111.
And then also under R418111, it specifically states that she must notify the board of these criminal summons or activity arising directly or indirectly out of the person's conduct of the person's professional activities. These charges were completely unrelated to any of her professional activities. There was nothing alleged in the course of any of these cases that this stemmed out of her profession as a medical professional.
Yeah, there is one issue that probably is somewhat problematic, and that was if you look at R4-18-111, and that was basically just unprofessional conduct, and that's ARS 32-150-0131.
Is she alleged to have violated that statute in addition to R418111?
It's just an option on the ARS 32-1501-31, just unprofessional conduct. I guess, you know, Dr. Pat, just real quickly, can you just give me a summation? Was this a school board issue and it was an opposition of some sort so the board can move on?
Yes. So back in 2020, our children were forced to do online learning with Zoom and all of that because it was COVID. At that time, I had a skilled football player in the district, and he kind of was getting a little bit out of control. So I had started to pull him out of football practice, and this made the district kind of upset because he was one of the star players on the team. I'm sorry, I'm really nervous, so I'm probably breathing weird, but so the principal came to me, kind of confronted me, and then somebody had leaked some embezzling history of this principal, so I had brought that up in a school board type of meeting, and 8 days later, I was banned from all of the schools without any kind of due process, those kind of things. The principal then made me start emailing permission to come on campus, and he decided if I would be allowed on campus or where I could sit or if I could vote or where I could park my car and that kind of thing. And then eventually he kept changing the rules of the ban where now I can only email during business hours. I can only email to him and that kind of thing. So anyways, during this small time frame of an injunction being put in place, and the time that the police came to let me know that these emails were still going out, 3 emails asking to attend permission to attend a game went out outside of business hours. So the harassment is that I sent 3 emails asking, can I attend the game on Monday? But they were sent out in universal time code instead of Mountain Standard Time. So that's the extent of what's considered harassment in this case.
And to clarify that last statement she made, Dr. Pettit had used a scheduling system called Boomerang, so she wouldn't forget to send out those reminders. If she didn't send out those requests to attend games, she wouldn't be allowed to go see her children's games. And so using that scheduling system, there was an error where they used a different time zone, and it's not clear to the user that the time zone is set differently than the time zone you're in. So those emails went out outside of business hours completely by accident. But otherwise, the content of the emails, they were three separate emails, and all were just one-line emails, requests to attend games. And the state considered that to be harassment because it fell outside of the time window. And that was what was proven at trial when Dr. Pettit was acquitted, that there was no intention to harass there.
I would also like to mention that the football coach is involved in this, and he is our county attorney. So it was a pretty big battle for us to go against the school when the plaintiff is technically also the prosecutor. So.
Okay, thanks for explaining that. I'm going to ask other board members. So let me ask Ms. Gellin, do you have any comments or questions?
No, I'm just listening right now, thinking about it.
Okay. Dr. Campbell?
Nothing for me.
Dr. Spatt?
I'm just curious. What happened to that football player? Did he ever play again?
He did not take any of the scholarships that were offered to him, so everybody lost in this case.
Okay, thank you. That's the other question I have. Thank you.
Dr. Brown?
No questions.
And Mr. Miller?
No questions for me.
Okay. So we've got a couple options. One option is to do a letter of concern for unprofessional conduct, although I do see Dr. Pettit's point of view. Or the other is obviously to dismiss. There's a couple options we have, so I'm going to need the board members to chime in and let me know which way they'd like to take this.
And Mr. Chair, members of the board, if I could jump in for a second. It's not in the investigative report, but there's another subsection of unprofessional conduct. Subsection C relates to committing a felony, whether or not involving moral turpitude, or a misdemeanor involving moral turpitude. In either case, the conviction by any court of competent jurisdiction or plea of no contest is conclusive evidence of the commission of the felony or misdemeanor. I know there was no felony conviction. There was a misdemeanor conviction. Whether unlawful grand jury disclosure is an offense involving moral turpitude is an open question, but that's just extra information before the board begins deliberating.
Do you want me to go into what the disclosure was or no?
And I can speak on that as well. The unlawful disclosure of a grand jury transcript is a law that, unfortunately, people are not typically informed of, you know, when they receive a grand jury transcript. And although ignorance of the law is, you know, not considered an excuse in the court of law, it's very understandable. Members of the public were asking Dr. Pettit for updates regarding her case. Many people were aware of it, just of the nature of the principal, as well as the prosecutor, being major figures in the county. And so many members of the public were asking Dr. Pettit for updates. And she posted a brief snippet of the grand jury transcripts online. What's important to note is the reason that this misdemeanor was created by the legislature was to protect the identities of the grand jurors. In the information that Dr. Pettit included of the grand jury transcripts, there was no information about any of the grand jurors sitting on that panel in that disclosure. So the disclosure was completely limited to a brief part of the testimony that was done by the officer. It did not include any private grand juror information. So the reason that that statute exists was to protect the grand jurors. That wasn't what Dr. Pettit did, but under the technical letter of the law. It was a violation. Dr. Pettit was not aware of that law, that she could not disclose the grand jury transcript online, but it was just a misdemeanor conviction. She took responsibility for it. And now that she knows the law, she's never, she would never violate that law again. But I don't anticipate there's ever going to be a reason where that opportunity would even arise.
So, Ms. Dr. Pettit, where are you currently with? Because it looks like you're up in Globe, Arizona, right?
Yep, I'm in Globe, and I'm sorry about the lighting. I have a giant window right here, and I'm trying to move the camera, but we're expecting storms, so the light's kind of getting weird. I practice in Globe, Arizona, and I've been practicing here since 2016.
Okay. And where are you now with the school district, the coach, the teachers in the school, superintendents, principals, all that?
We are initiating a civil suit for malicious prosecution.
Okay. And currently, in terms of discussing it, in terms of working through it, I take it Ms. Moss is helping you with that.
So Ms. Moss is my defense counsel, and going back to when I was banned from the schools, I knew that it was illegal not to be able to, you know, they kept me from the school board. I couldn't talk to anybody but the principal, who had a problem with me. I was given a plea. I could have taken a plea for $380 in misdemeanor court. And I denied that just based on principle, because I knew this was wrong. And like Rachel said, we went through two different trials, but finally the jury was able to see these emails in question. So we were found innocent. But still, we spent $200,000 and however many years on this. I mean, for me, this started in 2020 with the situation with my kids. So it's been kind of 5 years running, and I'm thankful it's finally over. And this is my next step.
And to be clear, Dr. Pettit is not desiring communication with the school in this case. She is going through attorneys for this, so she's not having contact with the individuals that were involved in the case, including the principal. And just as another basis for her civil lawsuit, something that plays into it, and I know she mentioned it briefly, that the prosecutor in this case was actually listed as a protected party under the injunction that was taken out against Dr. Pettit. And so he essentially was prosecuting a case in which he could technically be a victim, which is a major conflict of interest. So there is some basis that her civil attorneys have seen in pursuing a lawsuit. And so Dr. Pettit is doing this lawsuit out of the advice of qualified civil attorneys, but she is not herself having contact with these other individuals.
And also the principal at that time, he now resides in Florida. He resigned during this. The superintendent also retired. The assistant principal moved to another district, and the football coach quit this year. So there's actually nobody left at the Miami Unified School District who was involved in this. And my one child, who is still in school, we moved him to Globe District his freshman year. So he's a junior now. So there is no real communication with Miami Unified School District anymore.
Okay. I don't see it in the paperwork, but does Miami School District have any restraining orders or anything else on you?
No.
Okay. So, Ms. Gallen, let me drop back down to you, and then I'll go through the rest of the people. We'll come up with closure. Any suggestions, any ideas?
I do have a question. I don't know if anybody else can make sense. I'm just trying to understand the reporting requirement. Was that met? Not the conduct itself, just the, you know, there was this, and was it reported in a timely manner or was it not? I guess is where does anybody have clarity on that?
I think Ms. Anthony has that, or Mr. Hutchinson.
Yeah, I can jump in maybe and help. I guess there's two separate ones. There's the R418-111 that's in the IR. And I read that subsection A the same way as Ms. Moss does, where if it's, it would have to arise directly or indirectly.
Okay.
Out of the doctor's professional conduct for that one. There's also the unprofessional conduct of the committing, but I guess I'm going off base. There's no reporting requirement for that one. So to answer your question,
okay.
The way I read that rule, I agree with Ms. Moss.
Okay. Thank you. That helped me a lot. I appreciate it. That's where I'm at. I was just trying to understand if there was any concern there. More than the conduct that's kind of been evaluated.
Okay. So. Dr. Campbell?
I think just in general that the board would always encourage physician licensees to come to the board seeking guidance when, you know, they befall legal trouble such as this. There are, you know, so many different codes and whatnot, and you know, I think due diligence is important, you know, to seek guidance from your board, you know, in these cases. That way, when the anonymous complaints start rolling in and, you know, things like this occur, that suddenly you don't find yourself subjected to the entire text of the ARS, the nature and complexity of ARS. And so that's just in general, whether or not we want to assess some type of non-disciplinary letter, making it a notation of that, or if we feel that we can dismiss. I'm really open to either.
Okay. Dr. Chass?
I don't have any comment at this time, but I concur with Dr. Campbell on his statement as well.
Okay. And then let me drop down to Dr. Brown.
Yes, I'm also in agreement.
And then Mr. Meller.
I'm fine with a letter.
A letter of concern?
Yes.
For failure to notify the board? That'd be
yes.
If I could briefly be heard on that,
sure.
That point.
Go ahead.
Considering there is agreement here that she did not violate R418-111, I would request that it simply be dismissed rather than a letter of concern, because we all agree that this did not arise out of her conduct of her professional activities, which is what R418-111 dictates. And then once, and I understand Dr. Campbell's point that the board would appreciate, even though it's not technically required by R418-111, that the board would like to be able to give guidance. I think Dr. Pettit understands that now. And once she was notified, she was fully compliant and keeping the board up to date. We provided the board updates after the original trial. We provided the board updates once the trial was declared a mistrial, and we provided the acquittal paperwork throughout. So she was very compliant in keeping the board up to date once she realized the board was interested in this. So I think she's shown that this would not be a continued issue moving forward.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'll go ahead and throw out a motion to dismiss. If it doesn't pass, we can try to come up with something else. But, you know, we'll see if somebody wants to give me a second. So, again, Dr. Campbell, I make
this
a motion.
This is Diva Galan. I'll second that motion.
Okay, so we got a motion to dismiss. We have a second. Do we need further discussion before we do roll call? No. Okay. So we got a motion to dismiss. We got the second. And Ms. Anthony, do you want to do roll call on that motion?
Yes. Dr. Sadler?
With one caveat, please just report things, but go on to avoid, as Dr. Campbell said, all the ARS issues in the future. So, Ms. Moss, if you could keep us posted, if you'd be working with her, I would appreciate it. So yes. I'll go ahead, Ms. Anthony, and make the motion also to dismiss.
Dr. Saldick, was that an aye?
Yes.
Okay. Ms. Gollin?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Mr. Mellar?
Nay.
Would you like to explain your vote, Mr. Mellar?
I just felt that in the beginning she needed to notify the board.
And motion does carry.
Thank you, Ms. Moss, Dr. Pett.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Let's move on to 5B as in boy. And this is Dr. Amanda Marshall, case number 24-274. And this is the initial interview. And is Dr. Marshall on the line?
I am.
Dr. Marshall, do you have counsel with you today?
I do not.
You do not. Okay. And then I'll ask Ms. Anthony to go give us an overview.
Okay. Dr. Saldick, members of the board, on February 10th, 2025, the State of Arizona Naturopathic Physicians Medical Board received a complaint from DZ on behalf of her mother, CZ, alleging respondent's failure to disclose all the ingredients included in a PRP injection, which ultimately caused side effects, including triggering of a quote-unquote undiagnosed diabetes. Records indicate CZ had been a patient of respondents since August 22nd of 2022, with the last date of service being January 6, 2025. Although diagnosed with type 2 diabetes on September 2022, there's nothing in the chart indicating respondent instructed CZ to monitor glucose levels at home. There are no reports of any levels being recorded with the exception of the labs from 8/31 of 2022 and 3/8 of 2023. According to respondent, she did not specifically instruct CZ to monitor her glucose at home. On December 5th, 2024, respondent performed a PRP treatment on CZ to treat low back and right hip pain. According to the complainant, she became dizzy post-treatment, informed respondent, and that respondent told her it was normal and dismissed the dizziness. There is no notation in the chart note indicating this was reported by the patient. CZ alleges in her complaint that upon leaving the office, she experienced nausea and vomiting. However, admits to not reporting these symptoms to anyone at the clinic and did not report these symptoms until her follow-up appointment that took place on January 6th of 2025. Chart notes from that date of service do note these symptoms. According to the complainant, quote, no major actions were taken by respondent after she reported her symptoms that had suddenly onset after the PRP injection. On 1/9/2025, CZ was hospitalized with glucose level of 450. According to the record, she was diagnosed at the hospital with, quote, undiagnosed diabetes and was started on the medication metformin and was substantiated via hospital records. According to the complaint, on 1/23/2025, paramedics were called to CZ's home due to weakness, inability to walk or move, severe headaches, and dizziness. Paramedics determined blood sugar imbalances. To date, no records of this encounter have been supplied to the board. During the course of the investigation, the medical records for CZ were subpoenaed. The records received were partially documented in Spanish, along with the post-PRP aftercare handout. Anyone needing to review these medical records may not know how to read Spanish, therefore the records may be inadequate. Respondent had to be asked to translate any documentation she provided to the board in English.
Dr. Marshall?
Yes. I'm so sorry. I think you cut out.
I'm sorry. Your thoughts as to what's transpiring?
Yes. I did not ask her to, so in 2022, I diagnosed with diabetes. Her A1C was 7.2. We redid an A1C, in 2023 and it was 6.7. So it had decreased with, the care that I had recommended. The American Diabetic Association says that, at-home glucose checks should be done if you're taking insulin, if it's going too low, pregnant or having a hard time reaching the targets, but we were reaching our targets. So I told her to follow up again for further, monitoring and she did not. Hip pain had been ongoing, and I had, ordered an MRI, long before last year. In 2023, I believe, and she didn't get that. So I ordered a new MRI and that's all she wanted to talk about. So, well, I ordered two MRIs, one for her low back and one for her hip. And so based on the hip, I performed PRP injections and prolotherapy injections. There's two separate vials. One's pink and one's yellow. We talk about what they are before. I usually tell my patients, well, if you do PRP, the way we do it at our clinic is we will give a little bit of prolo along with PRP, because the prolo we use does contain some lidocaine that helps with comfort. It's a selling point. So I do always verbally give that to them before they come in for a treatment. I don't recall any issues that day. She did ask about the two separate vials and I told her what was in there. Lidocaine, dextrose, and a small amount of B12. Certainly not enough dextrose to raise your blood sugar. I did the math in my response letter, but it's minimal. And having done, PRP and well, more PRP injections on diabetics in the past, including in Mexico at the time it was SCNM, we never had an issue with it. Furthermore, the symptoms that made me more suspicious of uncontrolled diabetes didn't start till long after I injected. So way past the half-life. And at that follow-up visit, I did ask her to get those follow-up labs. I told her I was very concerned about her metabolic health as well as a couple of other things. In the complaint, her daughter had asked for ingredients. And while I'm with patients, I typically have our front desk staff respond to quick questions, but if it's not to the patient's satisfactions, they are always free to, you know, DZ is not a patient of mine. But if she wanted to speak with me about her mother, we do 15-minute free consults very often. But that wasn't requested. I don't know where she got the idea that we have NAD in our injections. We don't carry that in the office at all. Except in capsule form. So I don't, so I don't know where she got that idea. We gave them all their information, everything that was in Christina's chart. It looks like it seems that she made the complaint before reviewing the records that we gave her because diabetes was diagnosed, in 2022. I do have everything that I put into the chart documented. We did discuss on, three occasions what was in the, prolotherapy and PRP solutions. And it was not enough to significantly raise glucose and trigger her diabetes to the point of requiring insulin, as was claimed on the complaint.
Okay. And why do you feel she filed the complaint?
I believe that it was filed. So I was told, when she called the office, the ER doc that took care of CZ told her that, that little bit of dextrose, that 1 gram of dextrose that I had in the syringes is what triggered her diabetic symptoms. I was told he was quite insistent upon this. I don't know who this doc is. I wasn't even told which hospital he was, practicing out of, but he insisted that I was, that her diabetes was triggered by the injection. So I think that made her think that was true. And so she pursued all of this. Because evidently from her complaint, she had no idea that her mom had diabetes, even though it was documented on multiple visits.
Okay. So she had been a patient of yours since 8 of 22. Your last visit with her was January of 2025.
Correct.
Okay. And let's drop back to PRP. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with if they're having a vasovagal response?
So,
do you stay in the clinic after you've done the procedure? How do you handle that?
Yeah. So if there's any kind of sniff of any kind of vasovagal, we do blood draws. This happens every other day in our clinic. I'll stop and ask how they're feeling, if they would like the garbage can, if I can get them like a sucker, some glucose, some cold water. If they feel like they're nauseated, I might waft a isopropyl alcohol swab under their nose. We get them to lay down. So if they're in my room, they'd be laying down on a table. If they're in the lobby, we have recliners, and so we'd lift up their feet. And then we would, if I was alone in the room, I would get, the intention of somebody else just to come help monitor in case somebody needs to go and grab something else. And I have had patients vasovagal while doing injections before. So when that does happen, again, we'll pause, wait. Once they feel stable and ready, that is when I proceed with injections.
Okay.
And they would stay in the clinic. So typically what happens is, if they're in the room sitting down, I have them sit up, see how they're feeling. And then I'll have them walk to a chair that's just a few feet away. And if they're still feeling good after that, I will walk them to the front. And if they say that they feel 100%, I release them. But if we do stay late, I've stayed late earlier this week with patients who are not, able to safely leave on their own. Like, we will stay into lunch, we'll stay after hours, we'll stay into the next patient visit.
Do you have them come into the clinic NPO, or do you encourage them to eat prior? How do you do that?
So I let them know that like NPO may give them better results with PRP if we're fasting. I don't enforce it because some people vasovagal are more likely to vasovagal if they don't have anything to eat. So I don't believe I gave her instructions to fast. I didn't give her instructions to fast. I don't believe I gave her instructions to eat anything specifically before coming in. But we do have some organic lollipops for anybody who vasovagals.
Okay. And when you're doing the PRP, are you using ultrasound? You don't have fluoro. So are you doing an ultrasound? Are you doing it by palpation? How are you doing it?
Palpation. So, typically I'll, if I need to, depending on the location, I will mark, the bone structures, what I need to look for, watch out for, what have you. I will mark with a, iodine swab. I'll clean after cleaning with alcohol. I will clean with iodine, particularly the areas that I intend to insert the needle. But it is largely palpation.
Okay. And how long have you been doing PRP for?
professionally since 2021, but I did have been doing it as a student. And I used to shadow even in my undergrad. My last year of undergrad, I shadowed Dr. Soar. I would say probably my last 2 years of school is when I started doing injections on NWB trips and the clinics there.
Okay. And let me drop back into one other item. Diabetics. Mm-hmm. What's your protocol for a diabetic? Say the hemoglobin A1C 7.6.
Mm-hmm.
And morbid obesity, et cetera. What's your protocol at that phase?
So it also will depend on what they are already doing. But say they have no idea, they haven't been to a doctor in a long time. Because anything over 7 is considered poorly controlled, I will say my protocol has changed since being a resident. Anything over 7, and if it was a 7.6, I would request metformin. Or we can discuss other medications like, you know, the other anti-diabetic medications if they don't tolerate metformin very well. If anyone is over 5.4 percent on the A1C, I give dietary advice, you know, with protein, fiber, and exercise. If they're pre-diabetic, or like with Christina, she was 7.2, and I felt that she was motivated and her results showed that she was, I also gave her some herbs to help bring down blood sugar. So I typically give all the dietary and lifestyle advice. If it was at 7.6 or above, we would be discussing diabetic meds, and we would discuss different options as far as herbal or botanical solutions as well.
And would you be putting that in what portion of your soap note?
Everything that we decide on goes into the patient summary that is printed out, given to them, as well as shared into their patient portal. We use Charm. I'll make notes to myself if I think that something might be good down the road, or certain considerations, I might put that in an assessment, or if I something that I want to discuss in the future, there's a notes section that's not necessarily part of the chart note. I do put information in there so that's ready for the next time. I don't believe I did for CZ.
Right. And there's, as you know, that some of the injections were not charted. Do you know what transpired?
I'm not sure what you mean, the injections weren't charted.
So every injection you gave her, did she do a waiver on, and did you chart every injection?
I charted every injection. The waivers are typically done at the front desk and then scanned in. I know that the one to PRP specifically was not in her chart, which is more likely because the rest of the waivers done on paper were uploaded. So it was likely that one was... I'm not sure what happened because I wasn't there. The front desk might have lost it in the shuffle. I was under the understanding that it had been completed.
And is this your clinic, or are you working for an organization?
I work at Keystone Natural Family Medicine, owned by Dr. Kristen Bishop.
Okay. So are you an employee of hers then?
Correct.
Okay. Let me run it by the other board members. So let me start with you, Dr. Spatt.
Thank you. How are you doing, Dr. Marshall?
I'm good. How are you?
Okay. Take some deep breath. You're doing fine.
Thank you.
I just have a few more questions I want to ask you. So, remind me again, how long have you been doing prolotherapy and PRP?
So, about 3.5 years professionally, and more or less 2 years as a student.
Okay. And so have any things similar like this have occurred to you before on this particular patient, like similar, like patient with diabetic, or let's say you have any side effect from previous PRP or prolotherapy?
I have treated diabetics similar to CZ, but none of them have reported these reactions.
Okay. Okay. Now, I'm really glad that you know very well about the diabetic protocol, but I'm just curious. Have you referred any patient with diabetic to an endocrinologist in your practice at all?
Usually if I refer to an endocrinologist, it's because they're type 1 or they need insulin monitored more closely. I don't feel as far as simple diabetes type 2. I feel like we've had pretty good success handling that in our clinic, and I don't find that endocrinologists offer more than what we're offering.
Okay, so with this particular case, with this patient, since you're aware of her history of diabetic, so what happened? How come she ended up, enlighten me again, how would she end up in the ER, and what happened, what inspired her to go to the emergency room and so forth?
So I hadn't seen her in, I think, approximately in over a year for labs.
Okay.
I requested them and she didn't do them. So I think in that time, her diet and lifestyle were not consistent with my previous recommendations. And so it, over a long time, worsened to the point where she developed these symptoms such as she did.
Okay. So the last time when you gave her prolotherapy was how long before she went to the ER? I just want to see the timeline on it.
So one moment, please. I have it written down. I gave her, I injected her on December 5th of 2024. She came in a month later, January 6th of 25.
Okay.
With some symptoms that concerned me. And then she was hospitalized on the 9th and the 10th.
On the 9th and the 10th in January?
Yeah, so like almost a month and a half later.
Got you. Okay, all right. Okay. Well, that's all the questions I have for now. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Dr. Marshall.
Thank you.
Hi, guys. This is Daniela Zavala. I am the daughter of CZ. So whenever I get a chance after you guys go through your board members, I'd like to also input my part and just clarify a couple things when I get a chance.
And Dr. Brown, your thoughts?
Okay. I think the treatment was pretty good, and she was following proper protocol. My only question is about the chart note being written in two different languages. That makes it kind of difficult when you're trying to go over it and see everything. Is that a typical practice in the clinic there to do chart notes like that?
So I am the only Spanish-speaking provider in the clinic. So because CZ was primarily Spanish-speaking as a courtesy or just to help her understand, I did provide hers in Spanish. At Gail's request, I did create a single document with all the different treatment plans all laid out in English for the board.
Okay, thank you. It just when people are reviewing, medical personnel are reviewing the charts, it makes it a little difficult.
Mm-hmm. I understand.
Yeah.
Dr. Campbell.
Thank you. So I understood that you advised that within a year's period of time that while you had ordered labs for the patient, that the patient didn't get those labs done. How many times did you input the labs and make the request to the patient to have those done during that 1 year time period?
If the patient doesn't come in, I don't when they come in is when I tell them. So I
believe just twice. But the last victim, oh, go ahead.
Oh, my apologies. No, when somebody doesn't respond, do you make a SOAP entry to document the fact that the patient, you know, was requested to do labs and, you know, as of such and such date has not complied with that request?
I do not. It's a little hard to track who hasn't done, who has simply, you know, left the practice, maybe, you know, or they, there's not really a clear cut way on CHARM to track that in a very efficient way. So usually that is looked at on their, when they come back, I see that it's been a while since I've seen them. They need to get XYZ done. And that's when I, discuss that with them.
Have you ever had occasion when you have a patient that may have a concerning underlying issue and, you know, and time is going by and they're not being compliant, you know, and they get out there in the weeds and anything can possibly happen with their health, you know, be it expected and unexpected issues that you would either, you know, document a letter requesting that they come in or that they're going to be discharged as a patient and referred out to other area providers?
I do not.
Okay. No. As it's like a CYA type thing. All right. And then now, just for my own clarification, did, when you have a Spanish speaking patient, primarily Spanish speaking patient, do I understand that in CHARM, that you would, as you would for, say, a primarily English speaker, you would go in and do the same documentation, only you're doing the documentation in Spanish as opposed to English. Is that correct? Or do you do both? Or?
I typically give English or Spanish, but it's generally pretty direct translation. I do have some templates that are kind of one-to-one that just makes it easier to write treatment plans quickly. So I can copy and paste, and they're pretty, they're nearly identical, English to Spanish. Of course, would modify that as needed to, for specific patients, just to cater to their, specific needs if needed.
Okay. Now, let's see, humor me on this point here. Let's say a patient, that's primarily Spanish speaking, exits your practice and has a cardiac event in the parking lot. 911 is called and they are transported to the nearest emergency room, at which time you receive a call from the charge nurse requesting your chart notes be faxed to them immediately, as the treating physician wants to be aware of their medical history, any current medications, and the treatment that they just received to see if that in any way can help them assess and treat the patient that's emergent in the emergency room. Would they be receiving a chart note that's in Spanish?
No, so the chart note, so the face sheet with the medications, allergies, supplements, once they're input, they may not, would all be in English. My assessment, the S, O, and A of the chart note would be in English. It would only be the plan. And if that were to happen, my medical assistant does also speak Spanish. So if there was an emergency, she or I would be available to help that ER physician to make sense of the plan.
Okay, thank you. That's all the questions, Mr. Chairman, that I have for now. I may have more questions later if we hear from other people. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Campbell. Mr. Mellor?
I don't have any questions at this time. Thank you.
And Ms. Gallen?
I don't have any questions at this time either.
Okay. Let me hear from Daniela Zavia, are you the complainant's daughter?
Yes, I am the complainant's daughter, and the complainant is here with me as well.
Okay, we got about 3 minutes, so go ahead and we'll hear what you have to say.
Great. Well, I want to start off with the fact that even though the information on the records, medical records, show that there was diabetes as a diagnosis, that was not translated to my mom in her language appropriately. She has been told it was pre-diabetes, and so she was thinking in her head that I was, you know, I was pre-diabetic. Thankfully, her A1C did get better. However, there wasn't anything continued past that because I don't even know if 6.7 is optimal, and we looked for a natural holistic clinic so that we would be looking at ranges optimally. And so I think that potentially there might have been more room for growth there. She also mentioned that the doctor from the ER hospital, being a male doctor, inquired about the 1 gram of dextrose. I don't recall that. I don't know where they're getting that information. It was actually a female doctor that assisted my mom in the hospital, and she was just concerned about no proper diagnosis of diabetes, no glucose monitoring, and they were also wondering what was in this PRP injection because it was too close to the time of the hospital visit. I mean, the symptoms were prior to the hospital visit too. They were just worsening. And so we weren't aware of the prolotherapy, I guess, separate. My mom was just thinking I got PRP injection, and that's what was mixed with vitamin A, dextrose, B12, and NAD, according to the receptionist I spoke to from the clinic. That's where I'm getting all these ingredients. I wouldn't have gotten from Dr. Marshall because I haven't been able to speak to Dr. Marshall. We called a few times to get information. She was busy. I get it. We were expecting a call back at one point. We never got that. One of her assistants or the receptionist mentioned they would call us back. They didn't. And so we had to end up speaking with one of the receptionists to get the information of the ingredients. I ended up speaking to the director of the clinic, and she mentioned that, you know, they have many issues with the PRP with diabetics because of the amount of dextrose being diluted and small. But it did turn out that she mentioned, you know, I probably will put in protocol to screen the A1C for someone prior to PRP, and that's a conversation that she was going to take on with Dr. Marshall. And then she's mentioning about continued lab work or follow-up lab work. My mom is pretty well about following directions and, you know, listening to if the doctor asks for lab work, she will get it done. And she's got it done twice before. She follows through. However, this time around, whenever she saw her after that 1 year mark, my mom was coming to see her for the back pain and the PRP whenever that was introduced as the possible treatment. The diabetes could have been basically not dormant, but like silent, the symptoms, and still continue with diabetes, thinking however the patient was thinking was pre-diabetic and that she was in the clear based off of the 6.781C. So that's the main aspect here. My mom also mentioned that she was not walked up to the exit the day of the PRP injection, even though she was, you know, telling Dr. Marshall, I felt dizzy, is this normal? It was dismissed. Not, she's like, it could be normal, you're totally good. She wasn't walked up to the front. My mom ended up just saying, okay, all right, well, I'll listen to you, right? I'll be fine. Walked out, and then that's when she started having those symptoms of vomit and all of that. That's in the report.
Daniela, is your mother currently on any medication?
Yes, she's on metformin, insulin shots, and then she's on Lipitor, and I'm trying to think. I think I'm not 100% sure what the fourth medication is.
You know when she started these medications?
Yes, she started the medication soon after the hospitalization for the metformin alone, and then the insulin and the Lipitor was a couple weeks after that once we saw a different physician.
So is this before 1-6 of 25?
Before 1-6 of 25? No, I don't recall. It would literally have been right after the hospitalization, and I don't recall the dates of the hospitalization. I think it was 1-9 or 1-10.
Okay. All right, thank you. So board members, there's a couple of options that we have. One would be a non-disciplinary order for CME, basically on charting. The problem is with consent agreements, et cetera, consent agreements, all those should be verified or viewed before we go ahead and do the procedure. And then the other thing would be all the records are done in CHARM and they, for the most part, they look good. They could probably use some touch up. The other item we could consider or discuss would be some CME on diabetics. Dr. Marshall, do you use a CMG? Do you encourage your patients to use a CMG? Do you encourage them to check their glucose randomly? What do you do with that?
Now I am a lot more frequent with the CMGs because they're a little more available financially on Stello. So I do if we're struggling to meet the goals, or if the A1C the blood sugar goes too low, or too high, then, or if we're on insulin, that's when I am a little more forceful with the CGMs, or glucose checks, as, discussed about the American Diabetes Association, recommendation.
Okay. So a couple items are out there for discussion, and I'll need to hear from the board members. Let me start with you, Dr. Spatt.
Okay. Dr. Marshall, after hearing what Danielle say about what's going on with her mom, I'm concerned regarding about your charting as well. And also regarding about getting back with the patient when they call you for questioning. Did you get any notification, or did your front desk tell you that they try to get hold of you, or what's going on?
The only notification from the front desk I got regarding communication with Daniela was that she was calling asking about the ingredients. And I relayed to the front desk, you know, those three ingredients that we have and use. And that was the last I was personally contacted about speaking with her.
Okay. So when you did the procedure on Danielle's mom, did she have any side effect after the injection? Do you really recall what happened with the event?
As far as I can recall, PRP injections aren't the most comfortable thing. So there was, some discomfort, but, not the dizziness or the vomiting or any of that. And if she had mentioned something to one of the front people at the front desk, I was not made aware after the fact.
Okay. Dr. Marshall, when you do the PRP, I just want to know. So you draw the blood from the patient and you do the centrifuge, right? And then you take the platelet out and you inject it back to the patient. Am I correct?
Correct. I'm not the one drawing the blood. But I am the one doing the injections.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. You know, but I just want to, when you do the platelet injection, the PRP, you do it by palpation, or you do by ultrasound? I'm just curious.
Palpation.
Okay. All right. All right. So when you did the injection, the patient was okay afterward?
As far as I could assess, yeah, she did not display the typical, even vasovagal response that I do sometimes see.
Do you have any, do you give the patient any, handout of aftercare, for the injection at all? Do you have any of those instruction for patient at all?
Yeah, so we have one in English that we often give. I did, because CZ was the, for Keystone, the first Spanish-speaking patient that I treated, I did quickly translate the same document using Google Translate and print that out.
Oh, okay.
Spanish, language.
Okay, so when you give the injection to CJ at the office, was her daughter there, or just mainly she's the only one there?
I have never met Daniela.
Okay, I got you. Okay.
That's true. We did meet in the first initial consult.
Okay.
I didn't have a form sign there. Okay. It's been so long, I didn't recall. I apologize.
Okay. All right. Well, that's all the questions I have, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Okay. Let me circle really quickly back up. Mr. Miller.
I think my main point of concern here would be just with patient communication. To me, that seems one of the more pressing problems than maybe how things were done as far as the practice. And I'm not sure if it was from the front office or just communicating clear with the patient. But any sort of CME, if we can do anything with that, would make me feel a little bit better.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mallard. Dr. Campbell?
Yeah, I concur with everybody so far. I think that that the AADE, what the American Association of Diabetic Educators, also offers some neat CME training as well that might be helpful. And I think they have one that not only gives physicians the opportunity to have their continuing education, but it also provides them comprehensive knowledge, and the practical skills to effectively support and document their conditions. So it may help with both documentation and cutting edge treatment options that have, come out recently.
Okay. Do you happen to know offhand the hours that is?
I believe they have like six different courses, and I think they're 4 hours apiece.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Gallen?
Yeah, I don't have anything to add at the moment.
Dr. Brown?
I think the patient care was okay, but again, with the communication, I think it was a communication problem. So I recommend that for the charting and also with charting. So I recommend that if Spanish is going to be used, that there's also an English translation with the Spanish. That would include, that should ensure continuity with medical personnel, interpretation, and that would help enhance patient care when someone else gets the chart, if, the interpreters are not available. Also, with following up with patients' concerns and family member concerns, that seems to be something that was lacking as well. So proactively addressing concerns and finding out, if there's a concern, let me follow up. Let me make sure that I answer all the questions for the family member and for the patient to make sure that they understand what their diagnosis is and what's going on with them. I think that's something that should be addressed.
Okay. So there's some, I'll throw out some possible language for a motion. One would be non-display CME order for patient charting. Two organizations offer that. One's the AZMA and one is, of course, from PBI. And the other one would be, per Dr. Campbell's suggestion, if there's six courses in there, 4 hours apiece, perhaps the executive director could send those to the board, or I can review them with her. Dr. Campbell can, either way, and decide which would be most relevant. So the motion would be to utilize either PBI or the AZMA charting course, and also continuing education on diabetic management. And then we can look at the amount of hours. I want to get that out there and see if we can come to closure so we can let Dr. Marshall go back to work. Seconds, amendments, thoughts?
Do you want to do a letter of concern as well?
Yeah, be a non-display, letter of concern with non-display CME order.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, can you rephrase back on the whole emotion that you put on the table?
Sure. It'd be a letter of concern and then non-display CME order. And then for the charting portion, there's two courses available. One is through the AZNMA and the other is through an organization called PBI. That's one part. And the other part would be diabetic management And that course could be reviewed by Dr. Campbell, myself, Dr. Spatt, Dr. Brown.
The CME, how many CME do you need on top of the 30 that we have, or do you want to include in the 30 that we have?
I think Dr. Marshall's got a fairly, you know, good handle on diabetics, but some of it's new, some of the treatments are different. So perhaps I'm thinking 8 hours of diabetic management. And then the, I believe the AZNMA charting course is 8 hours. Now that could be that could take part of her 30, or that could be an addition to her 30. And that's going to be up to the board members to decide.
And how about public communication as well?
Yeah, then that would probably be more under the PBI, continuing education course.
Okay.
So I believe, Ms. Anthony can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that PBI charting and records course does have patient communication, et cetera, built into that.
Dr. Sadlick, yeah, I believe so. I just don't know how many hours they are specifically.
Okay. So Dr. Spatt, Dr. Campbell, Dr. Brown, any more thoughts?
No, I don't have anything else.
What does the board think of allowing part of this to be her 30? Or does the board want her to do her 30 plus this?
Mr. Spatt, let's see, the 30, and then how many units is the diabetic? 8?
That would be 8.
Okay. And then
then the PBI, the AZMA, I believe, is 8. PBI is quite a bit more.
Okay.
CME hours. I mean, her charting, her basic charting is pretty much there because she's using CHARM.
Right.
Just some finite tuning would be helpful.
I think it should be.
I'm sorry, Dr. Brown, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, I think it should be part of the 30, not in addition to the 30.
Okay. So I'll throw the motion out there. Again, and then Dr. Speck, did you have any thoughts on the motion?
No. I think you pretty much conclude very well. So you can go ahead and reiterate it on what you want on the motion, and let's see where we go from there.
Let's do that. Okay, so I'll make a motion that we basically do a letter of concern, non-disciplinary CME order. It would be for 8 hours of charting. Most of this she already has, so this would be finite tuning. And then it would be for an additional 8 hours of endocrinology, specifically relating to diabetic management, CGMs, and all the various new items that are out there, and medication treatment, which would be included in those courses.
Hey, Mr. Fitzpatrick, I second that motion.
And Dr. Sadlick, just a couple things. How long does she have to complete these hours?
In all fairness, I think probably I'd be more than happy 4 to 5 months. 4 months is fine.
And those are included in the required 30 each year, correct?
Correct.
And then regarding the letter of concern, can you please state what the concern would be?
The concern would be lack of proper documentation and patient care management.
Okay. I think we wanted to add a communication, patient communication, because the patient, I guess one of the complaints, she didn't realize she had diabetes. So.
And Dr. Brown, would that be in the letter of concern?
Yes.
Okay. So patient communication issues.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so we have a motion, Dr. Salvik, and then we have a second. Dr. Spat, did you second that?
Yes. And I agree with Dr. Brown as well.
Okay. And is there any further discussion on that, or did you want me to take roll call?
Let me run through for a discussion real quick. Dr. Campbell, your thoughts?
Nothing further.
Ms. Gallen?
Nothing else.
And Mr. Mellor?
No, I'm good for a vote.
Okay, thanks. So let's go ahead and do a formal roll call then. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Spat?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Mr. Mellor?
Aye.
Motion carries.
All right, let's go ahead and we're going to move on to, we're going to 5B.
Oh, excuse me. Mr. Hutchison has his hand raised.
Yeah, sorry to jump in here. Could I ask, since we have an IA for number 8, if we go out of order and take that one before we move on to the next?
Yes. Yeah, then no problem. We'll do that. So we're going to move on. We're going to hold on 5C, and let's go ahead and go on to number 8. And that would be review, consideration, and possible action regarding administrative law judge's decision. And Mr. Hutchison is with the state on this one, and Mr. Hargraves will be our board attorney on it. And I'm going to make a motion to go into executive session for legal advice.
There a second?
It is the spot, I second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
I see an executive session. All right, looks like we've got everyone here. Let me do can you do a quick roll call for us, please?
Yes. Dr. Sadler?
Here.
Ms. Gallen?
Here.
Dr. Campbell?
Here.
Dr. Spatt?
Here.
Dr. Brown?
Here.
Mr. Mallar?
Here.
So it's 1:39 and we're out of executive session, and we'll be going back to item number 8 on our regular agenda. I have a script that I'll be reading, so the board members can either read along or listen to it. This is the time and consideration for administrative law judge's recommendation decision in case number 24-242 NMB for Jose Ortiz, license number 07989. Are all the parties present? If so, identify yourselves.
Afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the board, Casey Hutchison for the state.
Thank you, Mr. Hutchison. As a preliminary matter, I will ask all board members indicate that they have received and reviewed.
Can we check to see if the respondent or their attorney are present?
Sorry about that. And yes, Steve Mahaffey representing Dr. Ortiz, who is also on the phone line.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mahaffey. As a preliminary matter, I would ask that all board members indicate that they have received, reviewed the record consisting of the administrative law judge's recommended decision. Yes, everyone has?
Yes, received.
Okay.
Yes.
And then we'll go on to...
Can we do a roll call just for verification for each individual member, please?
Sure. And
Dr. Brown,
Dr. Sadlick, Dr. Campbell, have you?
Dr. Spatt, I got it.
Dr. Spatt, Dr. Campbell?
Yes, I've received and read.
And Ms. Gallen?
Yes, I have.
Is there anyone I missed?
No. Mr. Mallar?
Okay. Yeah,
Mr. sorry.
Yeah.
All yes, right. We see them red.
Who are these other people?
Let's go ahead and move on to oral argument. The board will now hear oral argument from the parties on the recommended decision. Please understand this is not the time for you to re-argue your case. Please focus on the recommended sanction and any changes you are requesting the administrative law judge's decision. Each party will have 5 minutes. And we'll start off with Mr. Hutchison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. I'm not going to take nearly all of the 5 minutes. I'll be brief. I guess just the state's position is, and as you can see from the, the state's position is that it met its burden as evidenced in the findings of fact that the alleged violations were sustained. That said, I'm not making an argument to the board, and I defer to the board's judgment with respect to accepting, modifying, or rejecting the order.
Wow. Thank you. Licensee's argument, 5 minutes.
Thank you, Dr. Sadlak. This is Steve Mahaffey, attorney for Dr. Ortiz. We recommend, of course, that you accept the recommendation of the administrative law judge. Her findings of fact were comprehensive. Her findings of fact and conclusions of law were comprehensive. She considered all of the evidence put before her, and arrived at her considered opinion. I would also note, and since you've indicated it's not the time to rehash things, I will note, that I see on the agenda items number 9, 10, and possibly 11, today, are an acknowledgement that you have not adopted a definition of a minor or office-based practice, and you have not adopted a code of ethics. So not only was the judge correct, but you have substantiated her opinion by having those items. And we know them to be true. You haven't adopted a code of ethics. I mean, that's just a given. I'm not trying to be snarky or anything, but you haven't. And so you really can't hold Dr. Ortiz to your ethics because the board hasn't adopted those ethics. And that's what the ALJ found. And so I ask that you accept the findings of the ALJ and dismiss this matter. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Hutchinson?
I don't have anything else to add that I haven't already said. Thank you.
Thank you. Having reviewed the administrative law judge's proposed findings of facts, conclusions of law and order in the case, the administrative record, and the arguments from the parties, the board will now deliberate. In the event the board votes to consider modifications, the parties will have an opportunity to meet and confer regarding the proposed changes prior to the board's vote. The meet and confer may occur today or may be scheduled for a future special meeting, and that would have to be fairly soon according to the calendar. We'll move on to motions. Is there a motion for the findings of facts? If so, we'll need to get a second.
This is Dr. Campbell. I make a motion that the board accept the findings of fact and conclusions of law as indicated.
Thank you, Dr. Campbell. I need a second to Dr. Campbell's, please.
This is Dr. Spatt. I second that.
Thank you, Dr. Spatt. I move that the board accept the findings of fact, paragraphs 1 through 64, as recommended by the ALJ judge.
That motion has already been made by Dr. Campbell and seconded. You don't have to make another motion on that. It's just a matter of voting on that motion.
All right. Motion for conclusions of law.
That was included in the motion. It was the motion to adopt the findings and conclusion from the ALJ.
And
I'll vote on that.
And Ms. Hargraves, how about motion for board order?
Well, you have to vote on the motion that's on the table first. Once the findings and conclusions are voted on, then you can move to the order.
Okay.
So, I'm sorry, this is Gail. Dr. Sadlick, we have the motion was from Dr. Campbell. Dr. Spatt seconded the motion. Would you like me to do roll call?
Yes, please.
Okay. And Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
And Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Mr. Mallard?
Aye.
Motion carries.
So, Mr. Hargraves, you want me to move on to the next session for discussion? Is conclusion of law?
No, that was encompassed in that last vote. The next action would be on the ALJ's proposed order.
That would be the final decision for the board's order. The board may make a motion to accept the ALJ's recommended order, or it may make a motion to consider modifying or rejecting and or substituting. So I'll need a motion to accept the ALJ's decision.
Mr. Chairman, this is Dr. Campbell. I'd like to make a motion that the board accept the ALJ decisions as articulated within the order.
Thank you, Dr. Campbell. I need a second.
Dr. Spatt, I second it.
And Gail, roll call.
Okay. And Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Mr. Mallard?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Next, we move on to finally with conclusion. This concludes the matter before the board. The board's decision will be reduced to writing and sent out to the parties shortly. The appeal rights will be set forth in the board's written order. Thank you all for attending today. Thank you, Mr. Hargraves.
Thank you.
Board members, let's go ahead and let's move on. We're going to have to digress back to number five. And I believe we are on 5C. And then after that, we'll take a short break. So 5C is Michelle and Matthew, unlicensed case number 24-273. And this is a continuation, if you recall, of last month's initial interview. And I'll ask Ms. Anthony to give us a rundown of what's transpired since that.
And Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, at the meeting of February 13th, 2025, the board reviewed case number 24-273 and found respondents have been using the protected titles in connection with an Arizona location, charging fees for services, and selling medical devices. At that meeting, the board tabled the matter, allowing respondents 30 days to scrub the internet at large. The audio from the meeting had been included with the summary as a reminder of the board's concerns. On 3-3-2025, a review of the website, drmeandyou.com, reflects the continued use of doctor in the name, continue to claim it is used for educational purposes only, and they continue to sell the VoiceWise report along with wellness master classes. There are two issues the board must take into consideration as they review this case. First one is the use of protected title, use of credentials, which may lead the public to believe they are licensed physicians. Given the information before the board to date, does the board believe respondents have met the board request to scrub the internet at large of all references? The second is a potential consumer fraud issue. Respondents suggest they are merely acting as educators. However, it is clear that they are charging a fee for services, selling service memberships, and selling devices such as, but not limited to, the H-Wave therapy machine, which they claim to be a, quote, drug-free way to eliminate pain and restore natural vitality in the body. The posted cost of this machine is $3,960. In the event the board agrees there may be a consumer fraud issue, it would be appropriate to forward the matter on to the Arizona Attorney General for their investigation.
Thank you. Board members, your thoughts on 5C?
Is there any way I can add any extra context or no at this time?
Sure, go ahead. Go ahead.
So I just wanted to also acknowledge and apologize. Last time my nerves got the better of me and I wasn't able to answer your question, Mr. Bruce, on what we actually do and educate on. And so I wanted to make sure to kind of clearly articulate that we look at wellness patterns and daily habits and personal goals. And, you know, we'll do a session where we teach them how to essentially kind of tap into that self-awareness and self-scan into themselves. So they're being very participatory within their wellness goals and what they're looking to accomplish. In addition to that, we also do iridology. We're certified in iridology as practitioners and teachers. And so we use that tool to kind of help them explore insights with their strengths, stress patterns, you know, overall wellness tendencies. And then we do offer, you know, master classes where every, you know, Wednesday we get on a call and do, you know, global perspective health, concepts, and answer questions about, you know, the global perspective of different health concepts that people bring to the table. We did scrub as much as we can. I'm not sure, you know, that are, as far as I can see on our website and many other places, we scrub the word, the moniker doctor attached to our names, immediately. We did that from the moment that we received the complaint. And In addition to that, when we first received the complaint, we immediately responded and started changing things. And then we also jumped on a phone call with Gail to understand further the implications and the different moving parts to it. And we started scrubbing things immediately, everything that she highlighted. And then we also paid for a company to go and look for more stuff outside of just our website. There was a lot of stuff that we were able to have people take down. And then there were some things that we never heard back from. We communicate with them multiple times in order to try to get them to remove the moniker from our name. But there were several people, as you'll see in the notes, of that happening. And then again, with the H-Wave, we weren't selling it. We were just posting the information on our website. And then they would connect with the company for them to, do whatever it is that they're going to do, right? Either buy it or they can also rent it from that company. We just thought it was a good tool for people to be educated on and kind of just be aware of, because there's so many different things out there. And then just to reiterate that on our website, we define doctor all the time as just education, that we never treat, that we don't prescribe anything. And we tell people this verbally anytime we connect, and or obviously it's on our website next to educating people about water. So I just wanted to share. And again, apologize for not clearly articulating from your question the first time. It just, I understand the seriousness of this, and we have no intention of wanting to fool anyone or to get them to think that we're something that we're not.
Board members, let me drop down to you guys for questions. So, Dr. Campbell, can I start off with you?
Sure, thank you. Mr. Ensign, the board, thanks you for appearing today. I guess in general, what I'm trying to figure out here is that, with regard to Arizona revised statutes and protected titles, things that talk about naturopath and MD, NMD, ND, et cetera, that all of those things are, of course, removed off of your website. That way there is no confusion when someone is reviewing or finding your information online that you are, you or your staff members are not licensed physicians in the state of Arizona. We don't want to have, even that perception. And then also, with regard to this $3,200 device that you guys sell, is this like some type of a glorified TENS unit, or can you help us understand what this thing is and why it would cost so much money, et cetera?
I just want to clarify that we don't sell it. Again, we just put the information on our website because we went to one of the longevity summits out in California, and we connected with them. And so we, when they suggested it, I said, it sounds great. They can connect with you guys and learn more and do that dance. But it's an FDA class 2. I don't know if I would call it a glorified TENS. But it is similar in the fact that it's microcurrent, and that it has a high wave and a low wave. High wave goes at 60 hertz. And so the waveform is very different than a TENS unit. And so on the low wave, it helps pulsate and helps start pumping the blood. It vasodilates the blood vessels using microcurrent. And then obviously on the high wave, it's mostly for, as I understand it, pain, and discomfort. And, they're in the VA, they've been around for I think, you know, 30 years, and they have a lot of studies, you know, within context of their device.
Now, with regard to if I come across your website and I click into that device through your website and end up making a purchase, does that company give you any type of financial incentive or kickback as the result of that purchase?
Yes, there's a referral.
Okay. And so, all right, I'm going to go ahead and sit on that for a little while. Mr. Chairman, that's all I have for right now.
Thank you, Dr. Campbell. Dr. Spatt.
Can you circle me back? I'm still thinking about this.
Okay.
Thank you.
Dr. Brown.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about the name, and I'm still thinking about it because it's at Dr. Me and You. That's the name of your clinic. So I'm just letting that marinate a little bit.
No, absolutely. And I also
go ahead.
And Dr. Brown, I don't mean to interrupt that. And if that is the board's biggest thing, we're happy to shut down the name completely. You know, we're only here to educate. We're not trying to fool anyone. We're not trying to distract anyone from what we are. I grew up with a family of doctors. And again, the way that they've always taught me in my upbringing is doctor in words are important. And so we've always felt like the word doctor means to teach. And that's, you know, how we've always defined it on our website and to people. And if the biggest potential hangup is even the title of the website being that, I mean, we're happy to comply with anything to make sure that there is no gray area at this point, being very, very educated and understanding the point of view of the board.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Mallar, you had your hand up, sir.
Yeah, I just had a couple of questions on, and when you schedule a Zoom call or a meeting,
yes, sir.
What exactly, what's the protocol for that? What do you go through? Do you take life history? What is exactly?
Yeah, we like to kind of understand where the patient's coming from and what their goals are. And so, yeah, we do take a little bit of health history and lifestyle information. And like I said, because we do iridology, we also have them send in their pictures of their eyes so that we can, you know, look at that information all together to be able to look at different, you know, again, daily habits, you know, personal goals, movement. You know, for example, if someone came in with blue eyes based off of iridology research of hundreds of thousands of eyes, you know, they have a tendency to have, you know, sluggish lymphatic. And so because they have a tendency towards that, according to, you know, just having blue irises. And again, we say like, this is, we always tell them, this is just for education, you know, and one of the things that, you know, blue eye people can benefit from is, you know, more walking, to pay attention to walking or movement, you know, dry brushing, you know, hydration. We talk a lot about water. You know, a lot of people don't drink enough water or drink barely anything, or they think that, you know, having salads, is enough for their water content. And so we do a lot of education on that kind of basic lifestyle, daily habits for a lot
of
people.
Do you do any nutritional counseling?
No. I mean, we go more into, I mean, I guess it depends on how you define nutritional counseling, but I mean, we definitely talk about eating whole foods, you know, and eating, you know, vegetables, and that the body is built to be alkaline. And so, you know, vegetables are a good way to create alkalinity in the body. And so we emphasize that kind of stuff. And if someone, you know, comes to us and part of their, you know, lifestyle habits is drinking Coca-Cola, we definitely suggest that that might not be the best thing. And then we start teaching them, for example, reading labels is another, you know, major thing, to really take time to read what's in the products that you're getting.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Ms. Gallen?
I don't have anything to add. I'm just thinking about it and listening. Thank you.
Any other board members have anything?
When someone comes to you for a consultation, are you looking at any type of any labs or anything and recommended that they go and check them again after they finish with your treatment to see if they're improving? How are they going to know if they're getting better?
Usually they'll just tell us that they're feeling better, but they don't really come to us again to get treatment, because again, that's not what we do. You know, we try to be as clear as we can on our website to say that we're educating. And even when we connect with people, we do the same thing, that if someone comes to us for a condition, we don't treat conditions. We don't treat and or diagnose things. So, you know, ours is basically on the sense of their goal, right? So maybe their goal, for example, is to drink more water because they know that they need to, right? So we create the goal within the session, like water or, you know, more vegetables or reading labels. And so we judge it based off of, you know, that concept rather than, them doing follow up blood work. Everyone that we connect with obviously has a primary physician that they connect with to do that kind of follow up work. You know, we're trying to, go into people's lives within the scope of their day to day habits of either, you know, journaling or doing self-scan so that they can check in with themselves, that, you know, if they're noticing something going on, they're not calling us to figure, you know, they're calling their primary physician, obviously. I don't know if that answers your question, but if it didn't, please reframe it. I'll do my best.
Yeah, I was just trying to figure out how your interaction is with the patient, your client, when mm-hmm. they come in for a question answer session for 40 minutes.
Yeah.
What that actually looks like.
Again, you know, so we spend the first go around going through figuring out what their goal is, right? So a lot of people know they want to get better, but how, you know, what does that look like? What is the first step? So we go through, you know, their history and their lifestyle, to figure out what that looks like. And then again, we make suggestions on, hydration, deep breathing. I mean, I can't tell you how many people when we ask, like, do you actually take a moment to yourself to just, you know, breathe in and breathe out? A lot of people say no. A lot of people sometimes will suggest that they go on, you know, a vacation in their mind, you know, that they can't get away. And so that's their goal. And then, you know, then they'll share with us what that experience is like. But in the 40 minutes we do, you know, sometimes a lot of times we'll do an exercise within that 40 minutes. Again, like the self-scan exercise of being able to, increase your awareness about what your body is doing so that, you know, we live in our bodies 24/7. You know, we always tell people, like, you're the best, you know, you're your best, advocate. And so we need to train your senses so that if something's going on, that then you need to make someone aware of it. You can make us aware of it, but we're not going to be doing what, licensed physicians are doing on being able to check things out in such a dynamic and specific way. So, you know, ours is really about, you know, wellness at home and trying to help them figure out, because they're not hopefully in a doctor's office 24/7. They're in a doctor's office, let's just say, for 45 minutes to an hour, hour and a half, maybe once a month, maybe every couple months, maybe once a year, but the rest of the time they're on their own. And so we're trying to educate and essentially train them how to check in with themselves and how to essentially make minor changes that will either increase their awareness or increase their wellness habit of, again, hydration, oxygenation, you know, journaling, you know, then obviously Dr. Dan was saying about nutrition, you know, some basics on, you know, eating more vegetables to create an alkaline environment, which is really good for the body.
Okay, board members, we're going to need to wrap this up. The way I see it is we've got a couple of choices. He can either perhaps look at becoming a coach, health coach, or wellness coach, whatever it happens
to be? Well, we have wellness coach certification, sir. So okay. We have wellness life coach.
You need to get that doctor title totally off the site. And I don't know how you're going to do that, but otherwise.
Oh, no. We'll just close down the site. It's no problem. If that's the biggest worry, then we'll just close down Dr. Mean You and create a URL or a title that doesn't use the word doctor.
Dr. Campbell, your thoughts, Dr. Spatt, Dr. Brown.
I mean, Mr. Ensign, you said that your teachings from family members were the doctor's teacher. And so maybe switching that out with simply the word teacher might.
Oh, 100%.
You know, because doctor comes with a certain level of trust and mm-hmm. expectations from public perception, and we just have to be really careful here. Maybe we should bring this back to the next board meeting, and if everything has been changed, you know, then we can disposition this next month. I don't know, you know, that way we keep a handle on it, but move forward.
Is that a motion, Dr. Campbell?
Yes, let's go ahead and make a motion for that we hold off to the next meeting.
And you don't actually have to make a motion to do that, to just table something for the next meeting. You certainly can if you want to, but you don't have to.
Sounds good.
This is just Dr. Spatt. Yeah, let's go ahead and tailor this for next meeting until we see the website is being corrected, and then we can revisit again.
Well, just to be clear, the website won't be corrected. It's going to be shut down, right? I mean, that's
okay.
That's what you guys are.
That's fine.
I just want to be clear because you can't just like, if I change the website to teacher, let's just say you and me, that's fine. I can change the language on the website, but then the URL is still going to be Dr. Mean You, which is what ultimately you also want changed. You want that taken down also with the actual link, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. So then you won't be able to literally, obviously Google will keep it in its search function. So it might show up, but when you click on it, it's going to give you, obviously it's not going to take you to any website anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
Mr. Miller.
I didn't have anything. I did notice he did put that there was no naturopathic, physician, licensed naturopathic physician in any state that worked with him. So I think you added that from last month. I don't remember seeing that before, so that's appreciated.
No, I added that prior to when Gail was giving me initial feedback.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was before even the first meeting.
Oh.
I added extra content like that, 100%. But, yeah.
Any other board members have any thoughts? And I think we have Dr. Campbell, Dr. Spatt, and Dr. Brown. We'll table this till next board meeting, which is in 30 days.
And Dr. Salek, I'm sorry for the interruption. This is Gail. Just so I'm clear, you're tabling this matter again, and you're giving them another 30 days to shut down the website completely?
Correct. So if he doesn't shut it down in 30 days, or the URL or whatever still exists, then it just goes to the AG's office.
Can I just ask, and I don't know if this is possible, is there any way to request that we create a resolution and I will literally, I can shut it down right now for you?
Yeah, we don't have time for that right now, but we'll go back through this in 30 days.
That's fair. Yes, sir.
Any board members have anything else?
I mean, I think it would be a good idea if it has the capability to do it now, and we'll reevaluate and double check it in 30 days.
No, that's fine. I mean, yeah, I'll do it today. Yeah. No, it's fine.
All right. It is 2:09. Let's go ahead and take a maximum 10-minute recess. When we get back, we'll be going through items. We're on item number 6, so we need to kind of hustle. Take a 10-minute recess, and it's 2:09. Gail, you back?
Yep.
Let's, it's 2:18. We'll do a quick roll call to see who's back.
Okay. Dr. Sadlick?
Here.
Ms. Gollin?
Here.
Dr. Campbell?
Here.
Dr. Spratt?
Here.
Dr. Brown? Mr. Mellor?
Here.
So we're just waiting on Dr. Brown, looks like?
Yeah, it looks like it.
Okay. Let's give her another 2 minutes or so. Dr. Brown, are you back? Let's give her maybe another minute, Gail, and then we can, okay.
And Dr. Sadlick, I believe we left off on agenda item 6.
Yeah, exactly. That's where we left off. Okay. So I'm gonna jump on that.
Dr. Brown, are you with us?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I believe we have everybody. It's 2:21. We're back into session and we're back on to our next item was number 6, review consideration possible action regarding the status of judicial review action filed by Colleen Huber and Mr. Hutchinson.
Sure. I don't have any updates since last time. The oral argument in the Court of Appeals is set for the 25th at 10 a.m. So we will see how that goes.
Is that April or March?
Oh, sorry, March. So in less than 2 weeks.
Okay. Anyone have any questions for Mr. Hutchinson on that? Okay, that takes us out of 6. And let's move on to number 7, review consideration and possible action regarding application for medical assistant. And I'll have Gail go over this for us.
Okay, and Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, this is for a medical assistant application, Stephanie Naputi. She did have an affirmative background answer on her application. She, this was an event that happened in 2011-2012. She did submit the required written supplement, and that has been passed on to the board as well. And staff recommends approval of the application.
So I'll make the motion for approval of application, Stephanie Naputi. It will need.
Move up, I second that. Do we need a second motion?
Yeah, I made it. You seconded it. And
roll call, please. And Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
Ms. Gollin?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Mr. Maller?
Aye.
And motion carries.
Okay, so that takes us into number 9, review consideration possible action regarding definition of minor for office-based surgical. And I'll have Gail give us a quick rundown of that.
And Dr. Salek, members of the board, this has been on our agenda a few times prior to this. And I believe that it would be in the board's best interest to move forward with defining minor surgery in statute and or in rule. And so we've talked about, and I've given some examples of other states that license naturopathic physicians and their examples of what minor surgery is or what office-based surgery is. So I'm just putting this back on the agenda. And again, I am just encouraging the board to move forward with potential definitions.
Gail, just over spot. I thought we agreed to adapt on the Utah one definition for minor surgery from Utah.
Didn't we? Yes, and so the board did talk about that, and I was asked to send out a email relating to that particular definition. I did send that out. We did get responses from the profession at large. That was gone over a while back during board meeting, and then we didn't move forward with anything in particular. So I don't know how the board would like to proceed with this.
Yeah, this stuff is bad again. Sorry. Sorry, Dr. Campbell. You know, I know that the AZMA at one point did put in an input, and we come to I guess mutual agreement on it, but then something didn't go through, so I don't know what blocking it. So I think this is a good time for us to revisit it and hopefully come to a conclusion somewhere for minor surgery definition.
I think, Dr. Spatt, it's going to have to be decided by the board. And probably try to get that, you know, done, but, you know, before midsummer, because it needs just to be done. I mean, I'm hoping the AZMA goes along with it. However, we do need to get that, you know, implemented, because that's going to go through, obviously, the legislative process.
Is this something that we are hoping to just adopt what's working well in the verbiage from another state or a combination of states, or are we going to do that and that's what we might recommend, or will we do that and have like a work session where we go over specific procedures, you know, whether they're permissible or not? I mean, just throwing it out there. Let's just say, for argument's sake, that there are 250 procedures that could be considered minor surgery. Does the board go through and address each of those 250 issues? And if something else comes up, the licensee would seek board guidance, you know, or special certifications, you know, like how the board has special certifications for oncology and some other things. You know, that way we give people an opportunity to, I guess, earn their, you know, or prove their ability to do whatever procedures that they're doing and put them on a path, to being able to do so, or is it do you guys get what I'm saying? I mean, do we need to have a more in-depth work session on this where we're going step by step, or is this going to be kind of a open-ended adoption of language and move forward from there?
Yeah, that's a great point. Let me ask the other board members. I mean, the quickest way to do it would be probably to utilize Utah or Washington, or simply the language of what's been taught within, you know, the school parameters. Obviously it's open for discussion, but we should try to look at closing this sometime, you know, by midsummer, if possible. This is going to have to be submitted. Anyone have thoughts?
Wait, Gail, what do you have so far in the documentation regarding minor surgery? What do you have so far? I know we did this before, and there was a lot of material from different states and also from the AZMA input as well. So what do you have so far? Maybe we can combine those and see what worked for us and come up with our own minor surgery.
Right. And so, and Dr. Spat, I did forward all of that information to you again, for your review. I know it's a lot and you may not have reviewed, been able to review it, but we do have, you know, the other states, some of the other states, Oregon, Montana, Washington, Utah.
The reason why I asked is because now we have a new member, Dr. Brown and Mr. Mallett. And so we mm-hmm. have new member that haven't seen it yet.
They have. And so that was forwarded this time around to them as well.
Okay.
So, I mean, it really depends on what the board wants to do. You can sort of mirror what, say, for instance, Oregon, Montana, Washington, Utah. Those are basic, like, those are really tight definitions, and they're based on, I believe, how the schools define minor surgery or minor office procedures. So you could define it that way. You can, you know, as Dr. Campbell was saying, you could define it and list, you know, things that could be included in or what the board would consider as minor surgical procedures, and have some sort of device where somebody could come forward and, well, maybe get a certain procedure approved via educational conditions and things of that sort. So it could be as technical as that. Or like I said, it could be as just really tight as it includes removal of foreign bodies and, you know, lacerations. I mean, it really depends on how the board wants to define it at this time.
If I can, this is Dan, if I can just, I like the idea of having tried and true, like the Utah bill, because we know that's kind of been in place already. But can we do a concurrent resolution where we have the code of ethics, the minor surge all in one, or do these need to be broken out individually in three separate bills, Gail?
And so what we're looking at right now is the potential to define what minor surgery is. That is probably going to have to go through a bill process. The board may, and Casey, you may have some additional information on this. I know, we could potentially do something in rule, both statute and rule. It really depends on what the board wants to do. It's probably best to do it through statute. Both take a while. So really, I don't really have one way or the other, or both ways, if you want to do it that way. That is just like the minor surgery issue. The code of ethics is a secondary issue that the board needs to review today. And my I think that the board can do that as simply as a substantive policy statement. We're adopting, just basically officially adopting this code of ethics. It's been out there all along, but the board would just be adopting this so there's no question in anybody's mind from this time forward that there is a code of ethics that naturopathic physicians licensed in Arizona should abide by. So there's two separate things here.
Got you. And that does not need a legislative, that part doesn't. So we Correct. Can do that on our own today and not have to worry about a rule or any legislative part. It's just for this.
Correct.
Section. Okay. I was wondering if we should combine some things. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other board members have any thoughts on the basically it was sent to everybody, and we may want to within the next couple meetings spend some time. It could be on item number whatever it happens to be, so that we can chop through this and get the basically get our definition of minor surgery and office-based surgery done. Do we want to set time aside at each board meeting to review and eventually come up with closure for this?
I agree. This is Dr. Spott. I agree with that idea. How about if we ask Gail again. She's going to be busy. But Gail, could you, and maybe we can like separate in different section. Let's say section A, B, C, and we try to hit those targets with the meeting as much as possible, so we can come up with a resolution on it.
Yeah, absolutely. However the board wants to do it. My plan was to keep this on the agenda until a time when the board is comfortable with a definition, and then move forward with however the board wants me to move forward, whether it's statute, whether it's rule, whether it's both. And kind of go from there. And Casey, maybe you have, you know, some suggestions on the best way to handle that, but.
Yeah, so for the definition of minor surgery would really fit best in a statute. It's kind of outside of the scope of what a rule can do. And I suspect that if you tried to put it in rule, you'd probably get that answer back from GIRC. And I'm not sure if even going the rule route would even be that much faster. Of course, you have more control over that because the legislature is not opening the books, so to speak. But it really, I think, ought to be a statute change.
In case you refresh my memory, that's about a year and a half or 2 year process?
Rulemaking or
statute revision?
Well, depends on who you know, I suppose. If you knew someone who was ready, willing, and able to take up the cause down at the Capitol, they do have a deadline of when new. I think actually the deadline is passed for this session of when new bills can be introduced, but they have, it depends. I think we're probably looking at next session though, absent some sort of extraordinary circumstance.
So what's the next, when is the next session?
From January to whenever they finish, next year.
Wow. Okay.
So we really need this. We really need a definition in mind fairly quickly. I need to take it to see if anybody will carry that bill. I have a feeling it won't be as difficult because we're tightening a definition on scope of practice. We're not expanding it. And so I don't think the legislature will give us much pushback on that. They may be very pleased that that is happening. The profession in and of itself may not be, but it needs to happen. And so this is where we're at. So if we can come up with some sort of potential language, and keep in mind as it goes through the legislature, things change at a rapid pace. But if we can come up with some sort of draft legislature or language for a bill, the sooner the better, and we can kind of go from there.
Yeah, just off the spot. So would it be, I'm sorry to trouble you, but is it possible you can send us, like, let's say section A, B, C, like you break it down and we're going to read it each, you know, each of it, and then we try to respond back for each section. And then next time when we have the meeting, we can say, okay, section one, this is what we're going to change, and this is what our input is, and so forth. Is it possible? I don't know how the vote feel, but I was thinking maybe we could break it down and then hit each section and try to correct it, and then we go slowly from there.
So, Dr. Spatt, are you referring to maybe a longer definition such as Utah's versus a short definition in terms of like Oregon?
No, you know, whatever we agree on, whatever we want to, it didn't matter if it's Oregon or Utah, if you could send it to the board member, and then let's say, hey, this section one, this section two, see what is, you know, what we can add, what we can delete from it, and then each one of us try to put our input in, and then we send it back to you so that, you know, maybe we can come up with a more comprehensive definition.
Yeah, absolutely. I can do that.
You understand what I'm saying? I'm just making sure.
That's a good idea, Dr. Spann. That may help us speed this along. What we should do then is, if the board's willing, is add it to our basically our agenda each month. That would be helpful so that it's tabled, so we tackle this and get this done sooner than later.
Okay. Thank you, Gil.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Anyone have any more questions or thoughts on that? Okay. Oh, Tracelyn, I see you on there. I don't mean to put you on the spot. Do you have any thoughts?
I do not. I need to get up to speed on this issue, and Gail and I have talked a little bit about it, but I'll need to talk to our lobbyists and get up to speed since I haven't been here very long.
Okay. Thanks. I appreciate it. Let's move on to number 10, review, consideration, possible action regarding adoption of code of ethics. We kind of brushed over this just a moment ago, but if Gail can give us a quick rundown, and then she did include, I take it everyone's probably looked at it, she did include an example of code of ethics, and this is from the American Association of Naturopathic Physicians. And so, Gail, I'll give it to you back.
Thank you. And so this is, I sent out the summary of the adoption of the Code of Ethics. Again, this has been around for some time. The board hadn't officially adopted it. And so I am encouraging the board to adopt this Code of Ethics from the AANP through a substantive policy statement and possibly through rule as well at a later date. But I think the fastest way to address this is going to be just through a substantive policy statement. So I gave you a little bit of a draft there, but if you would like and you want to move forward with this, I can draft the actual substantive policy statement, have it on the agenda next month. The board could approve or amend it, and then we can move this through the process of submitting it to the Secretary of State's office. So it's officially on the record.
Can we move on this now, Gail, just by adopting the American Association of Natural Professions Code of Ethics, just adopting it?
Casey, what do you think?
Well, I guess it depends on how you mean by adopting it. It would have to be, so you could adopt the substantive policy statement right now, today, which would incorporate the code of ethics, into the rules that way. It'd
just be sort of like a policy of the only
way I can think of right now where you could, adopt it like today. You could incorporate it into your rules formally. But again, that's a lengthy process. It has to be written down somewhere, in some fashion. And the substantive policy statement's the way to do that.
And I'm sorry, this is Gail. And Casey, I think, and forgive me, Mr. Mallar, if I'm misspeaking, but, can the board just, vote on approving a substantive policy statement, including the AANP standard of ethics, or do I have to actually draft a specific policy statement for them to approve at the next meeting?
You could, if the board gave you sufficient direction of what exactly, it wanted the substantive policy statement to read, you could go that way, or you could actually present them with the draft. All things being equal, the second way is probably cleaner, but I don't think I'd be terribly concerned with the first method, being that this is kind of a pretty straightforward substantive policy statement.
Right. Right. And we all have it in front of us. I mean, I'm just trying to save us a little time and effort. And I think this is something we can all agree on, I would think.
So Casey, can we adopt it?
You can.
Mr. Chairman, what do you think?
I think if we can roll it out today, then I'm pleased.
Then I'd like to make a motion to adopt the AAMP Code of Ethics that we all have in front of us.
I'll second that, Mr. Mallard.
Could I clarify? So it would be that the board issue a substantive policy statement, adopting that code of ethics, and incorporating it by reference where standard, of ethics or code of ethics appears in, rules.
Yes. So
from the ANP, do we have to specify that at all or no?
Yeah. So thank you. That's helpful. That code of ethics that you have in front of you.
Okay.
With regard to the AANP's code of ethics, I agree that adopting it is good. It has good patient autonomy, an area in there for not doing harm to patients, non-malfeasance, justice, integrity, all that kind of stuff. But will we come back and visit recommendations for enhancing the code of conduct? From the perspective or the sphere of being a regulatory licensing board, and while the AAMP's code of ethics does seem to have a pretty robust framework, I'm wondering if from our perspective, do we need to have things like a conflict of interest policy and definition, where we outline situations that may lead to conflicts of interest, personal interests and professional responsibilities and disclosure requirements and things like professional boundaries with patient relationships and collegial interactions. And then I know that the social media and digital conduct has been coming up not just on medical boards but other boards as well, online behavior, patient confidentiality, et cetera. Of course, it goes without saying things like cultural competence and non-discrimination, and unethical behavior, naturally. And so would those be things that we could come back and add on to our code of conduct later? Is that what we're referring to by adopting what we have now and revisiting something later? Or is that something that we should do in combination with what we're trying to adopt today? And do the other members feel any of those things are necessary? That's just my two cents worth with regard to looking at this from, a regulatory and licensing board perspective, and not simply just the perspective of, this is our profession and we're going to be professional and do everything that, we're supposed to do as physicians, et cetera. Does that make sense, everybody?
It makes perfect sense. I view this as a good foundation. So I feel you can always build upon your foundation, right? And certainly social media and some of the other things that we're seeing technology-wise certainly could be added to this, I think, at any time. But at least it gives us a starting point and a foundation on which we can build.
And this is Gail. And Casey, if I may, perhaps the things that Dr. Campbell referred to could be incorporated into separate substantive policy statements instead of trying to add on to the AANPs and making our own?
Yeah, you could do it either way. And you could come back if you had some. You could come back and modify or replace this substantive policy statement. Or you could come back and approve another one.
In a different area, such as media relations or, things of that sort?
Yeah.
Okay. So Dr. Campbell, yeah, so we could do it either way. We could modify this one, I suppose, or we could just separate out different policy statements on different topics.
Yeah, and I can always submit, after we adopt, do our adoption of, what we're going to do today, mm-hmm. I can submit my recommendations for an addition, and we can always adopt that at a future board meeting after the members have reviewed it and, added anything that they want to add. We have discussion, et cetera. We can do that at a future date. Thank you. Yeah, I was just curious if sounds good.
So Mr. Mellor made a motion, and I believe I seconded it, and it was for the adoption of the AANP Code of Ethics for a substantive policy, which Dr. Campbell pointed out some additional things that could be added on as time proceeds. So we've got a motion, we've got a second, and we should probably do a formal roll call on that.
Okay. And Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Mr. Mellor?
Aye.
And motion carries.
All right. And next we move to number 11, review consideration and possible action regarding Article 2 of a rule draft.
And Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, I need to apologize because I'm still working on that last revision that we talked about at the last meeting. So I was not able to get that completed and on the agenda in time. So my plan is to have that on next month's agenda.
All right, we'll table that for next time. And then we'll move on to number 12. And this is the executive director report. So we have 12, we have A through F. Has everyone had the chance to look at that? I take it everyone has.
Were there any questions on the report?
Was there any highlight scale that maybe should be brought to?
No, I'm just trying to keep track of the legislation updates. I've been sending you all out when they come in. The latest one was the one bill. That seems to have turned into a chiropractic bill, but we do have a portion referring to naturopathic left on it. That hasn't come up in front of the legislature yet, so I don't know how that's going to turn out. They may just remove that altogether. I don't know. But I am trying to keep y'all posted on how these things change. It's a daily basis, so we just go back in and we keep checking the status of the bills to see if there's any movement on those. So, you know, again, I'll keep you updated on anything that changes.
Any questions, anybody? Okay, so 12A through F is covered. And then future agenda items, I think we covered some of those. Mm-hmm. We'll be using time to finish our surgical. Anyone else have any future items that you want to add? Dr. Campbell, did you want to add more substantive policy, or do you want to roll with what we have and go on to the surgical and then possibly roll back into the substantive?
Well, I mean, I can just submit those ideas, you know, over to Gail and have her share them with you guys. And if she wants to add it to the thing, it would just be a quick adoption to, you know, add them as a supplement or something in a future meeting. Should be pretty simple.
Okay. Okay. Whatever works best for you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Thank you. And next we'll move on to number 14, which is call to the public. And we'll do our 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And that takes care of that. And finally, adjournment, unless any board members have anything else. No? Okay, so we're at 2:56 and we're officially adjourned. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.